I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable, a panel of international journalists discuss Turkey's military operation in Kurdish areas in northern Syria. What happens now that U.S. forces have pulled out? We'll talk about the investigation into whether Donald Trump abused his power by pressuring Ukraine to intervene in the 2020 election and the important issues facing the Supreme Court. Join the conversation on Your Call right after the news. Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. This week in the news poses a real challenge. Journalists have uncovered so many consequential stories, it's been hard to actually curate and figure out how to cover those developments in depth in just an hour. But we have assembled journalists, one who's live with us from Istanbul and two others here in the States. And in this hour, we're going to discuss, first of all, the events unfolding around the House impeachment inquiry and what's being called Ukraine Gate, plus the ongoing assault on the Kurds in northern Syria. And then we'll have the major issues being taken up by the Supreme Court. Let's start by introducing the journalists who will be joining us later in the show. We'll be hearing from Bob Gelko. He's a veteran journalist and legal affairs reporter in the San Francisco area. He works for The Chronicle. But right now, joining us from Istanbul, Turkey, we are joined by Borzu Daragahi. Borzu is a veteran journalist and international correspondent for The Independent, and he covers the Middle East and North Africa for The International. Borzu, thank you so much for joining us from Istanbul.
It's my pleasure.
And from Wisconsin, a bit closer to home, we're joined by John Nichols. John is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and he's also the author of several books, including one entitled Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America, and The Genius of Impeachment. Good to have you back, John. It's remarkable. That title is, in and of itself, every time I read it, I think, what did you know that we didn't know when you wrote this book? It's really good to have you on board this week.
It's an honor to be with you. And, you know, that title has served well over the years.
It's held up well.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, it's been difficult to curate just exactly how to cover all the things that have unfolded this week. But, Borzu, let's start with you, if we can. It would be really good to just kind of give a brief overview of what's been happening on that northern border of Syria as it borders Turkey. My understanding is that it was about 5 years ago under the Obama administration that about 2,000 U.S. troops/advisors were sent to that area to get help from the Kurds in trying to repel and control ISIS and drive out the caliphate. Is that the context under which what we're seeing now has happened? Is that an accurate way of describing how U.S. troops came to be in that area?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's pretty accurate. Maybe more like 4 years ago. Maybe it started building at 5 years. They didn't immediately deploy 2,000. But look, you know, you have this experiment in northern Syria where this kind of far-out group, YPG, which is the sister organization of the PKK, this kind of, you know, former Marxist kind of radical organization led by Kurds that includes some other minority groups in northern Syria, includes some Arabs and so on. They set up a sort of self-rule experiment, a sort of proto-state in northeast Syria adjacent to the Turkish border. And Turkey has been at war with this group for 40 years. Turkey has been fighting an insurgency against rebellious Kurds for 40 years. And this same group has set up this government here. Turkey viewed that as an existential threat, viewed it as a, at the very least, and very palpably, a territorial threat. that this would inspire Turkey's own Kurds to want their own state. And it has been super uncomfortable with this experiment for years. When the U.S. came in and kind of gave it legitimacy by arming it, by collaborating with it in terms of fighting against ISIS, Turkey had warned for years that this is not acceptable to it, that this is not what a NATO partner does to another NATO partner. And it has been warning that it is going to crush this experiment whenever it gets a chance. Well, you know, Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had one of their numerous conversations about a week and a half ago. And Trump said that he was going to remove troops from that area, and that would basically be an implicit green light for Turkey to do what it's wanted to do for years. And it is doing it now, basically doing what it can, the bare minimum. And the military strategy is very interesting and not very ambitious. Even though they talk big words about, you know, peace and resettlement of Syrian refugees and so on, all they really want to do is destroy this experiment.
The Kurds are one of the largest minorities on the planet, and they've been looking to establish a homeland of their own. And with the help of the United States, they were able to establish it in this sort of buffer zone between Syria and Turkey. And as you say, Turkey considered that a real threat, and they've been looking to dislodge the Kurds ever since, yes?
It's not just the fact that Kurds set up this region. As listeners may know, Iraqi Kurds have a region that borders Turkey as well. And Turkey does a lot of trade and business with this particular group. But the problem is, it's this particular group. It's this particular group, the PKK, YPG, PYD complex, that Turkey has a real problem with. And its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, two Turks is... And it's just important to recognize that you don't have to agree with it. To Turks, the leader of this group is like our Osama bin Laden.
But this is also the group that has helped to defeat the caliphate and drive out ISIS. And they're responsible for keeping something like, 16,000 or so ISIS fighters behind bars,
yeah.
Yes? So it sets
absolutely.
Up,
uh-huh. It's a complicated and morally fraught situation at this point. And, you know, there's no real simple answers as to what happens and what should be done and who is wrong and who is right. I think that the problem right now is that this conflict is causing a lot of unnecessary civilian damage on both sides of the border. There's been civilian deaths in northern Syria. There's been some civilian deaths in southeastern Turkey. And this is something that should be the focus of everyone's attention.
Well, John Nichols, it suddenly is the focus of American attention. Who'd have thought this time last week that Americans would be actually talking about the Kurds and what's happening in northern Syria and southern Turkey and a pullout of U.S. troops? This has suddenly brought into real relief what's happening there and why it's important to Americans. If you had to explain to Americans why they should be paying attention to this move by Donald Trump, what would you tell the average American? Why should this be important?
Well, I have been talking about it a lot because I think it's an incredibly important story, and I'm so honored to be on with a great journalist who's given us such good background from the region. The first thing I would tell Americans is that a lot of this has been framed as, here's a group of allies who have helped the United States, and now Donald Trump is shifting an alliance at a critical point. And that's sort of the top-line story, and it's an important one. We can get into it in a second. But I would tell him something else altogether, which is that many times in history, we have been aware of a potential human rights catastrophe, perhaps even something genocidal, and I use that word very carefully, and we have not acted quickly enough or well enough. What is being talked about in northern Syria is something that, no matter whether the Kurds had been allies of the United States or not, is horrific, and as a country, we should be conscious of that and be looking for ways, diplomatically primarily, but also structurally in all sorts of ways, to try and avert that catastrophe. So that's first and foremost. That human side of it ought not be lost. But in this case, we also have a remarkable circumstance where the Kurds stepped up to fight, not just in Syria, but in Iraq and other places. The Kurds have stepped up to fight battles that America, the United States of America, wanted fought, but did not want to fight. And, you know, as somebody who's not a big fan of U.S. interventions around the world, I'm glad we haven't sent, you know, large units of U.S. troops to new countries. We have enough spread around the world already, more than enough. But in this case, an arrangement was made with the Kurds. A lot of arrangements were made with the Kurds. The U.S. did provide at least some measure of support and sustenance for their efforts, and I think it can be argued that the U.S. benefited as such. Now it appears that Donald Trump, for all sorts of, you know, complicated personal reasons and political reasons of his own, is shifting the policies in such an irresponsible and ill-thought way that he is sending a signal not just as regards the Kurds, but frankly as regards all sorts of folks around the world who might choose to ally with the United States, work with the United States to try and achieve goals in very difficult parts of the world, that the U.S. is unreliable. And finally, the last thing I'd say is Donald Trump has been portraying the Kurds in his brief comments as regards them in incredibly ahistoric and irresponsible ways, including suggesting that they didn't help with the invasion at Normandy during World War II.
I thought that was just an extraordinary thing for him to refer to. Where did that come from?
It's just throwing whatever he can at the wall to try and suggest that you know, it's okay what he's doing. And one important thing, I'll point out there. Look, as our other guest has pointed out so ably, the Kurds are complex, and there's different groupings, and you know, there's a lot of history there. But the president was actually, you know, just so determined to portray the Kurds as sort of folks who have no history with the U.S. and who, frankly, got a lot of, in his terminology, got a lot of money for it or something like that, that I think even now a lot of Americans don't have an understanding of the Kurds. They're beginning to, as you suggest, but this is a real media gap here that needs to be filled in. It needs to be pointed out that the Kurds did not have a state. So to participate in the Normandy invasion would have been a little bit hard, structurally. But also that if you really want to go at history, some very good historians have stepped up to point out that there were, even during World War II, moments where the Kurds stepped up, and particularly in Iraq, where they were definitely, units of Kurds worked with the Allies against allies of the Nazis. So Trump's even wrong, you know, he's not just wrong in the current moment, but even as he tries to throw out this bizarre history, he's wrong in his history.
Well, Borzu Dargahi, let's talk about the images that are now coming out of the area of people, thousands of them, flowing out of northern Syria, scores of people, now that the U.S. forces have been pulled back, scores of people, including children, have been killed and injured. Thousands of people fleeing their homes, many of them with nowhere to go. This looks like a looming humanitarian catastrophe. I'm reminded when Bill Clinton asked, when he was leaving office, what was his greatest regret, and he said that he did not act to prevent the humanitarian disaster in Bosnia. So,
I think that, you know, let's be candid. You know, I didn't hear a lot of people lately protesting and, you know, howling when the Russian and the Syrian regime was bombing Idlib province just a few weeks ago and targeting hospitals and schools and so on. So I think that, you know, Syria in general, and not just the Kurds, the sort of fetishization of minorities is perilous in terms of the Middle East. So I'd like to avoid that. Syria is a compound tragedy, a disaster. The scale of the humanitarian disaster there, the failure of the international community, it is just the depth of the failure and incompetence and moral failure on the part of the Western leaders and the part of world leaders and the superpowers as well is just unfathomable. But I will say that that the Turks did a trial run of what they're doing now in the area called Afrin. And although there was a lot of problems in Afrin, in northwest Syria, where the Turks also dislodged this particular group and, you know, kind of did a small version of the vision that they want to implement here in the northeast of Syria, there was nothing approaching genocide. There were some allegations of kind of ethnic reengineering. There were some, abuses. There was looting and rioting and human rights abuses on the part of the Turkish allies in that corner, but nothing on the scale of, Rwanda. So let's not go there yet. But I would say that Syria in general is definitely on the scale of Rwanda.
Well, this wasn't unexpected. As you said, there was a sort of a trial run in that area. And, of course, President Trump attempted this move some time ago but was pulled back. So why now, do you think? Why now, Borzo?
I mean, I think it's just domestic politics. And I think that, this goes to domestic politics in the U.S. Donald Trump has a very, very, very narrow conservative base of support. If he wants to win some key swing states, he has to keep his conservative base in line. The Never Trumpers are never going to vote for him. Those parts of the conservative movement are outspoken and emboldened now, and so he's going towards the kind of John Birchers and the what are we doing in the Middle East type people, like the sort of right wingers who are kind of racist against the Middle East, and he's trying to whip up that base. And let's be frank, not being involved in the Middle East is popular among hard leftists and hard rightists in the United States.
It certainly seemed to play well to the crowd in Minnesota last night, where the president got cheers from the crowd when he said, we did a perfect job over there, and now it's time to leave. It's not our problem, basically. And it's time for the U.S. to leave the Middle East. John Nichols, it's a very appealing argument to say, look, we need to pull back those forces. But for those who say, as a result of this move, instead of fighting ISIS over there, we may be facing the prospect of fighting ISIS on the homeland. Is that a legitimate argument?
I don't know. There's obviously concern about ISIS prisoners in some parts of Syria who might, as Trump has suggested, become Europe's problem. And obviously, I think the president is aware that there are airplanes that sometimes fly from Europe to the United States. So there are certainly folks who may portray it as such. But I would be cautious in one regard here. And I so respect some of the comments as regards what's happening on the ground in Syria. But I think that understanding what the president is doing here with this, I think we should be careful about linking it too much to the impeachment inquiry and to the president's other problems. I don't think that the president fully understood what he was doing here. I don't think he's paid particular attention to the Middle East. I think it's almost folly to imagine.
So who is he listening to on this? Who's got his ear?
On this issue, I think he's probably listening to his instincts, which do go to some of what we've been discussing here, which is that he came to office as someone who said he wanted to pull back from a lot of places around the world, not just the Middle East. And there's talk among the Trump folks, some of them, of ending the quote-unquote forever wars. Get the U.S. out of places all over the world. And that's why you heard that applause in Minneapolis. I don't think it was particularly about this move. I mean, I will emphasize to you, I think even now most Americans are not following this at anywhere near the level that it would become, you know, that sort of political issue. And so I think the key thing to understand here is that Donald Trump has never been particularly enthusiastic about U.S. involvement in Syria. Frankly, an awful lot of people, as was noted, in both political parties have not been particularly enthusiastic. And so the debate about this in the U.S. It's lively, it's real, but it's not pushing aside the discussion about impeachment. And, you know, at the heart of what's going on in the United States is a very focused discussion about the president's problems, and obviously the president trying to push back in all sorts of ways. Last footnote on this is, as somebody who's covered the president pretty closely for a long time, it's my sense that the president was surprised by a lot of the reaction to his decisions and his statements.
Especially from Republicans, yes?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he was shocked that he got such a pushback.
Mm-hmm. Borzu Dargahi, we only have you for just a few more minutes, so can you just go over whether you're in touch with people inside of Syria, how Erdogan's decision and about this incursion is being viewed in his own country, in Turkey, and how is the media covering it there? I know that's a lot to roll in, but we only have you for about three more minutes. Can you talk about the what's happening inside Syria, the reaction there, as well as in Turkey, and how the media is covering this development?
Well, I think the Syrians are very divided, and those and even among the opposition, those allies, those nominal allies of Turkey, Syrian Arabs and Turkmen who are closely working with Turkey, there is some opposition to this this intervention, with people saying that, you know, yes, this Rojava, this Kurdish self-rule experiment, is not amazing. It's not, you know, a great success, but it was relatively stable, one of the few relatively stable parts of Syria. So it's a shame to be going in and destabilizing it in this particular way. And, of course, Syrian Kurds are very much opposed to this adventure, at least those that are loyal to the current group that's running Rojava. But there's other Syrian Kurds that are, you know, much more skeptical of some of the things that the YPG, SDF, PKK does, some of its recruitment tactics, its use of child soldiers, etc. And they're not happy with that group, and they're not happy with Erdogan either. In terms of the media, I'm like, you know, the Turkish media is, the pro-government media is extremely jingoistic, extremely pro-war, playing rock and roll as they show footage of the battles going on, whipping people into a nationalistic frenzy. I've seen it before with Turkish military operations, high-tech electronic graphics, etc., that make, you know, Fox News look somewhat subdued when they're covering a U.S. war. And, you know, there are some opposition voices. There are some opposition newspapers that have questioned the conflict, but they've been somewhat more quiet in the last few days as the war has moved in, and you get reports of Turkish young men dying in battle. So that has, you know, kind of rallied the people behind the effort.
Well, I'm wondering, there are people who are trying to prevail upon the president to reverse this decision. Is it too late? Is this just a done deal?
I don't know. I mean, that's a little bit above my pay grade in terms of what would happen if the U.S. suddenly announced that it would reverse the decision. I think that, you know, Turkey is already starting to bomb. It's started to move a ground incursion. It would just be a big mess if all of a sudden the U.S. tried to take up those positions again. But I'm also certain that, you know, the military commanders are talking, the U.S. and the Turks, and that they would, you know, they're working on deconfliction efforts, making sure that, you know, there's no friendly fire incidents and so on. So, you know, I'm sure they could, if there was a change of policy, it would be messy, but I'm sure they could reverse what has happened already.
Borzu Dargahi, a veteran journalist and international correspondent for The Independent, covering the Middle East and North Africa. So grateful to have you on the line with us from Istanbul. There's so much more meat on that bone. We wanted to talk a bit about the impact that the fact that President Trump has a business interest in Turkey, the extent to which that may have impacted this decision. There's so much to talk about, but we're so grateful for the time that you were able to give us. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks again, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. From Wisconsin, John Nichols is still here. And when we come back, we'll also hear from Bob Agelko of the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll be talking more about the impeachment inquiry. And what about those two arrests yesterday? What is the significance of that? Stay with us. If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Coming up on Monday on the weekly One Planet series, we're going to mark Indigenous Peoples Day by discussing how Native American traditional knowledge is actually helping to find solutions to the climate crisis. Really interesting conversation. The Karuk tribe is using its traditional land management practices to help California fight these mega fires that we're seeing unfold in the L.A. area. The Yurok tribe has granted personhood to the troubled Klamath River in California. Promises to be an interesting conversation. That's on Monday. Your Call One Planet series with Edith Elkind and you. Today it's the Friday Media Roundtable. So much to cover. 866-798-8255 is the number if there's a story this week that caught your attention. Let's move on to the story that's been headline news for the past 3 weeks or so, and that is the Donald Trump impeachment query. John Nichols is on the line with us. He's in Wisconsin. He's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and he's the author of several books, including my favorite title of the week, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, and also The Genius of Impeachment. John, what a time to have you on the line. Thanks for being here.
I'm honored to be with you, of course.
So, a new survey is showing that this is a Fox News survey, by the way. 51% of people polled support impeachment, not the inquiry, impeachment and removal of the president. That seems huge, and most of the movement appears to be among independents. How significant is this?
It's hugely significant. Look, as a historian of impeachment, I'll tell you this. The least understood thing about impeachment is that it is a political process, not a legal process. If you are impeached and removed from office, all you do is leave. And that's certainly very painful for a sitting president or official, but they don't go to jail. They don't pay a fine. They are just out of the office. And that's how the founders intended it. They didn't want this transfer of power, this necessary transfer of power, in a circumstance where someone had abused their position to get wrapped up with all the things they had seen in Europe, where there was, you know, like all the way up to jailing of former leaders and things like that. So that doesn't mean Trump would be absolved from legal responsibilities if impeached. That becomes another issue. But impeachment itself is political. The reason I deviate into that for just a moment is because the polls then become very, very important. The energy for impeachment, the willingness to move forward with some presidents is rather low because the presidents are popular and because the process is unpopular. A way to think of that is with Bill Clinton back in 1998-1999. Whether you agreed with the impeachment or not, it just wasn't a popular thing. It wasn't seen as necessary. The reverse of that with Nixon back in the 70s, there was a really rising sentiment that we were learning things about him that made him unfit to be president. My sense is that the polling tells us today that we are in a situation far closer to what you saw with Nixon than you are with what you saw with Clinton. And for Trump, that's a really tough place to be in. What it means is that the Democrats who launched what I would argue is a necessary impeachment inquiry now feel emboldened. They took a risk, And there were many people, even within the Democratic Party, who said, boy, if you do this, you're going to get incredible blowback. There may be, you know, a political consequence to it. They went forward. Nancy Pelosi went forward. And far from being a political consequence for the Democrats, it appears that as new revelations have come and as the inquiry has advanced, this has become a profound burden for President Trump. He does face the genuine prospect of impeachment. Removal is a much harder thing because of the Republican majority in the Senate.
Well, you know what I've been thinking, though? Let me ask you this. What if I think Americans, you know, are getting a civics lesson, a real-time civics lesson.
We really are.
Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing, in my opinion. Impeachment, it seems to me, is inevitable. It seems to me that impeachment, which is a function of what will happen in the House, and with a Democratic majority, it seems like it's going to happen. But what happens if they stop it there and don't refer it over to the Senate for the next steps? The impeachment will always still stand. There will always be that I next to Trump's name, and they don't have to risk sending it to the Senate where it's bound to die, and where once it dies, Trump can claim victory.
Very wise thoughts and good comments here. And let's parse them up just a little bit. First and foremost, if the House votes to impeach, that's effectively an indictment. And that then does go to the Senate. Once the impeachment vote has been done, the Senate will take it up.
And it's automatic. Is that right?
Yeah, it's essentially. Oh. And so, although, let me emphasize that the rules are a little more vague, and people have interpreted them in a lot of ways. But I think we're in a situation where if the House votes to impeach, the Senate will take it up. Now, if the House were to vote to censure the president, which I don't hear any great sentiment for, that could just stop at that point. But my sense is that you do go to the Senate. Now, here's a thought on this that may be worth pondering. You're right that I goes next to his name. He would be the third president in history to be impeached. Nixon wasn't impeached, but he was threatened with it and resigned. Andrew Johnson and Clinton were impeached. Mm-hmm. He would be the third president in history to be impeached. And the Senate has never removed a president upon impeachment. It just has never happened. So the fact that Trump might get off, right? He might be, quote-unquote, cleared by the Senate. I don't think necessarily benefits him as much as some people might think. I think impeachment itself is what is understood as the evidence of a problem. And then the Senate trial becomes very political. If a handful of Republicans vote with the Democrats, and you know, you obviously know who these people might be, Mitt Romney, perhaps Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, a couple others, maybe Mike Lee from Utah as well, then you might have a majority of senators voting for impeachment, and the president gets off just because a supermajority was required. That's not a particularly powerful tool to take into the 2020 election. And the final thing I'd point out on this is, we really are in somewhat uncharted territory here, fascinating uncharted territory, because if Trump doesn't get convicted by the Senate, he can run for re-election. He would be the first president in the history of the United States to run for re-election after impeachment, or frankly, even after a serious impeachment inquiry. And we don't know what the politics of that might be, but my sense is impeachment is a very awesome and powerful tool. And I think it does damage those who are impeached. And my sense is that the president, I would be very surprised if the president benefits politically by having had this carry out.
What's it saying to observers, John, that the White House has absolutely put a stake in the ground and said they will not cooperate in any way, not with documents, not with answering subpoenas, not with supplying witnesses. And Republicans are at great pains to come up with explanations for what's happening. Oh, he was only kidding when he was talking about bringing China into this whole inquiry into Biden. They're really at great pains to come up with a reason. So what does the stonewalling say to the average American?
I think stonewalling is something people understand. and I think it looks bad. Now, earlier in the show, we talked a little bit about the president's efforts to reach out to his base, right, to secure, you know, the folks he rallied with in Minneapolis, and you're going to see him do a lot of rallies. But the fact of the matter is that base is insufficient. Stonewalling, refusing to cooperate with the process, is precisely the sort of thing that causes independents who might not have liked the process or might have had a potential discomfort with it, and even, I might add, some sort of Main Street traditional Republicans, they maybe weren't thrilled with Pelosi for launching this, but now that it is in play and now that there is so much evidence seeming to argue for an inquiry coming out every day, including this day with testimony out in Congress, the suggestion that the president's not going to cooperate in any way, and all this bombastic portraying it in the worst possible ways, even suggesting it might be a coup, even suggesting or via a retweet that it might lead to something akin to a civil war. I don't think that plays well with, you know, kind of moderate mainstream Americans who believe that if you are a subject of an inquiry, you participate. And if you're innocent, you provide the evidence of your innocence.
There it is. It's simple.
Yeah.
People get that.
Yeah.
If there's nothing to hide, why are you hiding? And it was also pretty simple to say, it's just not okay to invite another country to find dirt on your political opponent. That's really simple. You know, I teach at Cal Poly. I teach messaging. It's like if you need it in a sentence, that's really short and sweet. But now suddenly we've got all these tentacles, John. All right, you've got these two Ukrainian American, I think one was from somewhere in the former Soviet bloc, these two guys attached to Rudy Giuliani, and the tentacles are now getting longer, and the sentence is now more like a paragraph. Is there a risk of losing people if this thing gets more complicated?
Very, very good question. I think the two enemies of impeachment, of an actual achieving an impeachment, first off, the articles being approved by the Judiciary Committee and then a full vote by the House. The two obstacles are complexity and time. If it becomes too complex, if it starts to look like something that seems to be going in every direction, I think there is a prospect that Americans might see it as just an effort to throw everything at Trump. So keeping things focused makes sense. You don't have to focus just on Ukraine. I think you can also look at the Emoluments Clause violations, which are so very evident. I mean, you look at obstruction. But, you know, there's a good argument for not going off in a thousand directions. And frankly, if the administration doesn't cooperate in simply saying, okay, they didn't cooperate, that goes into the obstruction file, but we're going to keep moving forward here. And that gets us to the second part. The timing is really important. Donald Trump's great genius as a political figure, and I'm often very critical of him for not knowing how things operate and not paying much attention to it, but he does have a genius for distracting. He has a genius for taking politics in different directions. And if this drags out for a very long time, you can be assured the president will eventually, perhaps, I should say, stop fighting it and start pointing attention in another direction, like start something else altogether. And for Democrats, that's not useful, and it could distract folks. The funny thing about it is, so far, as somebody who's looked at a lot of impeachments over a lot of time, and somebody who really agrees with your point on messaging and the simplicity of it, so far, what Donald Trump has done here has, I think, sped up and facilitated the impeachment process. His incredibly bombastic response, his kind of combat response rather than nuanced and thoughtful, I think has made the work of the Democrats easier, not harder. And one of the reasons for this, and I've criticized her in the past, I don't always think she's, you know, perfect in every way or something like that, but I think Nancy Pelosi has been in Congress for a very long time, more than 30 years. She gets how the place works.
Oh,
yeah. How to hold her majority together.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I think she's got Trump's number.
I think this has been masterful. I mean, even the idea of doing this incrementally. This is not an impeachment. We're not taking the vote. This is an inquiry, bringing the American people along, and in effect, flipping the idea on its head that we can't really wait for America to follow us. We're going to lead on this and bring people with us incrementally. I think she's been really, really brilliant. John Nichols, of all the folks to have on the air today, boy, are we glad we had you.
I am so glad to have this conversation. You've been great. Just your questions have been so spot on. I appreciate it.
You know whereof you speak. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of several books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, and also The Genius of Impeachment. John Nichols, thank you so much.
I'm honored to be with you.
We're going to move on. So much ground to cover. We're going to change gears now, and we're going to talk about the critical cases that are now facing the Supreme Court. Nine judges returned to the bench on Monday to start a term that is likely to be filled with controversy. There are major cases on gay and transgender rights, the issues of immigration, abortion, guns, religion, the power of the executive branch. All of these issues are likely to come up in this session, and we can probably expect a decision by June. But of course, that will be smack dab in the middle of a very, very contentious presidential campaign. So it's just remarkable that all of that could be happening, but that's what time it is in America. Let's try to get a better picture of what we need to be paying attention to in the coming month. We're joined by Bob Agelko. He's a veteran journalist and the legal affairs reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. It's so good to have you back, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Kind of a tough act to follow, but I'll do what I can.
Wow, but this is an interesting time to have eyes on the Supremes. So just hours ago, let me just run this by you quickly. An appeals court upheld an order for President Trump's accounting firm to turn over his taxes. A lot of people, there's been a real drum roll around that issue. Is that issue likely to be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, do you think?
Well, I think that's the next step. I mean, they could ask for a rehearing, go to the full D.C. circuit, but seems likely that they're going to be before the Supreme Court pretty soon, and whatever the court decides could well have implications for other types of subpoenas that the House would like during the impeachment inquiry. I mean, these were for financial records, and also when and if the case of the president's tax returns arrives there. As you know, we already had a ruling from a federal judge in Sacramento striking, or at least blocking, a California law that would require him to release tax returns in order to appear on next year's primary ballot. But that one's probably heading upstairs as well, and could well be before the Supreme Court before too long. But so there's questions of presidential power, House authority, and how closely you have to be connected to legislative action, because the dissenting judge today said this is a little too close to impeachment to be a legitimate legislative function, if I understand it right. She was a Trump appointee, but nonetheless, it's an argument that's certainly going to be raised.
Well, speaking of impeachment, with an impasse in the impeachment inquiry situation, at least for the moment, the scope of presidential power is an issue that could also end up in the Supreme Court. But there are other cases that are moving up in the courts that would decide just how much power President Trump or any president has over the legislative branch of government. Can you talk about that?
Well, one that comes to mind is the DACA program, Deferred Access for Childhood Arrivals. This is a program started by President Barack Obama in 2012 by executive order, allowing young people who were brought here usually by their parents before age 16 without documents and who have attended school or served in the military and have no serious criminal record to remain here for 3-year periods and get work permits and renew it indefinitely. President Trump has sought to repeal the program, and his first argument was that President Obama had no authority to establish it. That's kind of an interesting legal situation, because the question then becomes the scope of presidential powers. And some of the more conservative justices on this court, and you know, including the newest justice, Brett Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. have been advocates of pretty broad presidential authority. And here the issue seems pretty straightforward. The lower courts have generally ruled that a president has the power to decide whom to deport, and that can also include classes of people, such as this one, which seems less likely to be criminally dangerous. So if President Obama had the legal authority to enact this program, the question then becomes, does President Trump have the authority to modify or repeal it? And to do that, he has to give reasons to satisfy the courts as being rational. So far, he hasn't done that, at least in the judgment of the courts that have considered it. But the Supreme Court has been given pretty broad leeway to presidential authority. They did that when they upheld President Trump's travel ban last year, and they're going to consider DACA next month.
My guess is also among the cases that you're watching closely is based on the case last year, the Supreme Court overturned a Texas law that required abortion clinics to have surgical facilities and doctors to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. In effect, that almost shut down almost all of the abortion providers in Texas. At that time, the justices Alito, Thomas, and Roberts dissented. Kennedy was on the side of the liberal justices in the majority. So what is the case now that's in front of the Supreme Court? And do you think that this one is a test case for anti-abortion advocates?
Sure. This is a Louisiana law that is virtually identical to the Texas law. In fact, according to Louisianans who were opposed to it, if this law were to take effect, there would be exactly one doctor at one clinic available to perform legal abortions in Louisiana. It may not be quite as dire as it might have been some years ago because of the prevalence of medication abortions, but nevertheless, it would make the procedure much less accessible. As I said, this law is almost identical to the Texas law that they upheld several years ago with a five-justice majority, including Justice Kennedy. He's now been replaced by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and whose attitude toward abortion was pretty well summed up some years ago when he was on the D.C. Circuit, dissented from a ruling allowing immigrants in the federal custody to get abortions and called it abortion on demand. So he seems unlikely to be too sympathetic to positions of advocates for the right to have abortion. The first question in this case, though, is how bound does the court feel to follow the precedent that it set in 2016 when it said these laws are unconstitutional? Evidently, the Court of Appeals that upheld this law didn't feel too bound by it. They found some fairly small difference between the two laws. Chief Justice Roberts, though, who voted with the dissenters in 2016 to uphold the Texas law, cast a vote to keep the Louisiana law from taking effect while the case is pending. Mm-hmm. Whether that means he's had any second thoughts or whether it simply means he respects the court's precedent for now, I guess we'll find out when they argue the case. But if the court, I guess as widely expected, reverses itself and upholds the Louisiana law, it won't be the last one to attempt to restrict access to abortion, maybe without outright repealing Roe versus Wade. There are many others, these so-called heartbeat bills and where abortion isn't allowed once the fetus has a heartbeat and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I should just mention, as most listeners probably know, this wouldn't directly affect California, which has its own abortion access laws. This would affect states that try to restrict access.
But this has certainly been a very effective approach, literally running at the barricades of abortion access by doing it on a state-by-state basis and not mm-hmm. waiting for the Supreme Court to make this decision. But it'll be interesting to see how the Supreme Court comes down on this. Let's move to another hot-button issue, the case on whether federal law can bar sex discrimination in employment as it relates to LGBTQ employees. That question is whether employers are free to fire employees because they are gay or transgender. The court heard arguments on Tuesday. What happens? What's next?
Well, it was very interesting, and I guess one thing I learned a long time ago when covering courts is don't confuse questions with answers, because predictions can be pretty hazardous. Nevertheless, I mean, it's kind of all we had to go on, and judging from at least the transcript that I reviewed of the two arguments, of all people, Justice Neil Gorsuch seemed at least interested in listening to the argument that discrimination against gays and lesbians is discrimination on account of sex. Now, that was what was prohibited in the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act. It's pretty clear that the drafters of that act did not have lesbian, gay, or transgender employees in mind. Nevertheless, what they said was sex, and that's what the court has to interpret. Is dismissing a gay employee or a transgender employee discrimination on the basis of sex? And you can certainly make the literal argument that if you fire a woman who dates another woman for something that you wouldn't fire a man for, that might be sex discrimination. And Justice Gorsuch seemed at least interested in that. There are a couple of comments he made saying, well, isn't sex at least one factor, and isn't that enough? Whether he goes along with it or not, I mean, if he were to do that, then that would probably make a 5-justice majority to bar such firings, either for gays and lesbians or possibly for transgender employees as well. Although during the transgender hearing, Justice Gorsuch seemed more concerned with the effect of judicial intervention, saying, don't we need some judicial modesty here? Whether he was referring to all of the cases were just that one, I suppose he knows, and we don't, but we'll find out. Fact is, though, that the departure of Justice Kennedy, who is the author of all of the court's major gay rights opinions, would seem likely to have quite an effect on future gay rights decisions at the Supreme Court. He's been replaced by Justice Kavanaugh, and once again, I should mention that it shouldn't have any direct impact on California one way or the other, because California has its own gay rights laws, as do close to half the states.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. There are many cases, and we wanted to find out your thoughts on how Kavanaugh might come down. We're going to find out by June. A lot of these cases will be decided probably right in the midst of the presidential campaign. Thank you so much for joining us. We were also joined today by John Nichols and Borzo Daragaki of The Independent. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.